get started. Welcome.
My name is Connie Horton, and I direct the Counseling Center here at Pepperdine. And this talk is about raising resilience. How do we raise children to be more resilient? In my work, I get to see, as do my colleagues have joined me, I get to see a pretty concerning picture. There's a lot of students in college, including at Pepperdine and across the country, that have some really difficult times adjusting. Mental health issues are pretty rampant. We'll talk more in detail in a minute. Christian students are not exempt. They have a lot of problems too, of course, and sometimes I don't see their faith really helping them be more resilient, and I want to speak to that. I do get to speak to parents every year as they drop their kids off for college, and I always think, I wish I could have talked to them years ago, because preparing your kids for college and indeed for life doesn't start right before they start. It starts years and years before. So I'll just share some data, some perspectives, some research, but also just, to be honest, some of my own editorial observations and some scriptural integration along the way. So who's here? How many of you are parents? Coming primarily as parents. How about grandparents? Grandparents in the audience, great. Aunts and uncles, yep. Children's ministers? Yeah. Sunday school teachers, yep. Youth ministers, family life ministers, et cetera. It really does take a village. So I think it's helpful not only for parents to think about these concepts, but for the whole community to consider it. We know these scriptures well, right? Proverbs, train up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he won't depart from it. Or in the Message, point your kids in the right direction. When they're old, they won't be lost. Well, what does that mean exactly? We see a lot of lost young people. Another thing to think about is Stephen Covey's, one of his 7 habits of highly effective people, is to begin with the end in mind. People ask me how they should parent. I would say, well, what's your goal? What are you trying? What's the outcome you're trying to go for? And people sometimes think it's obvious, but I don't think it is. I think it's important to stop and say, as a parent, as a family, as a church family, what are you hoping for these young people as they grow into adulthood? For example, do you want them to be highly dependent on their parents throughout their lives, their young adult lives? Or are you hoping that they'll individuate? Are you wanting them to expect life to be easy? Or are you wanting them to be prepared to deal with difficulties as resilient people? Do you want them to believe because you said so, or because they've developed their very own faith? And again, that might seem pretty obvious. The answers are obvious when you think like that, but often I don't think we consider, as we're making individual parenting choices, youth group choices, Sunday school class choices, we're not considering which way is that going to lead us. Sometimes the short-term solution is not going to head us towards the best long-term answers. Let me just give you a quick peek at the world of university and mental health in a little bit more detail. It is pretty concerning. If you'd like to read more about this, there's a book called College of the Overwhelmed by Richard Cadison, who's essentially in my role at Harvard. And he talks about, this book is about the extraordinary increase in serious mental health issues on college campuses. If your son and daughter is in college, the chances are almost 1 in 2 he or she will become depressed to the point of being able to function. 1 in 2 that he or she will have regular episodes of binge drinking. 1 in 10 that he or she will seriously consider suicide. The information on student mental health is shocking, yet it's the elephant in the room that no one's talking about. Now, I would say people are talking about it in recent years, sadly, partly because of some of the tragedies, the mass shootings and so on. Hopefully it doesn't take that for us to continue the conversation. A few other snapshots about this data. 70% of directors, 70% or more, depends on the year, people in my role, if they're asked, what are you seeing on your campus? Are you noticing more serious mental health issues? 70 to 85% any given year will say yes to that. About a third of my colleagues any given year will have completed suicides, not just suicide attempts, but completed suicides on their campus, sometimes multiple ones. Our work has definitely changed. the whole experience in the university life has definitely changed. We change RAs and faculty and so on. People need to be on the lookout in different ways. Just the numbers that we see, the year before I came, 2004, 2005, our center saw 270. Last year we saw 606. Now part of it is because we've made it more accessible. We've eliminated fees. Part of it's because taboo and stigma has gone down. But part of it is because many more students are not dealing as well.
What are these figures?
These are the number of students who came for the counseling center. Oh, sorry, okay. I wasn't clear about that. Thank you. So more than double, right, in just a fairly short amount of time. Other studies have shown that that's fairly typical. For example, at another university center, they were showing, yes, absolutely more frequent, more severe, and more complex presentations in counseling. So more and more people are struggling. Again, if you ask people my role, they say it's increased. And also if you ask them, are students with psychological problems a growing concern in your center or on your campus? 96% of people in my role will say yep. So again, it's a national phenomenon. Something's going on. Just a few more slices, and I promise we won't do this the whole time, but just to give you the picture. So there's an instrument that many centers do on intake when they first start seeing somebody in counseling. Over 40% of students need a higher cut score on depression, or over 30% on anxiety. And then we also, at Pepperdine and many other campuses, we survey the larger student body, because sometimes people say, well, you have a distorted perspective, Connie, because you're just seeing clients. But that's actually, the clients are fairly representative of the general population. People are doing well, of course, perfectly well, don't feel like they need to come to the center maybe, but people sometimes who are quite in quite severe distress don't always come to the center. So when we do snapshots of the student body, these numbers weren't just, are you experiencing this? This is national, by the way, not Pepperdine. Not just are you experiencing these things, but are you experiencing them to the degree that they're interfering with your academic performance? So we know, for example, that stress to a certain extent is good for us, right? It gets us motivated and studying and focused, but 30% of students nationally are saying, I experience so much stress it's interfering. Not helping, but interfering. 21% say anxiety, 13% say depression. And not just whether or not it interfered academically, but just did you experience this at all? Over half of students say sometime in the last year they felt overwhelming anxiety, and we'll come back to that. Anxiety is a big struggle of this generation, or so depressed that you found it difficult to function, almost a third. Again, nationally, general student body, not clinical population. Last study, series of studies by Twinge and colleagues, they have found that this truly is an age of anxiety, that what is sort of average now would have been the clinical cuts a few decades ago. It's very common now to have anxiety in the air, and so for those who are more anxious, they're quite elevated. Narcissism is increasing and empathy is decreasing. That's very concerning as well, and I think has lots of implications for how we parent and how we do church community. In other words, people think the world revolves around them. Right? They're not very good as a cohort, and it's been empirically documented, considering others' point of view, considering when they write to a professor at 10 at night, the professor might not get to it within 5 minutes, to consider when they want an appointment, there might be a few other people who are ahead of them, considering that the parents might have a few other things to do besides meet their every demand. And I'm talking in generalities here. Of course, there are lovely exceptions, but overall, as a cohort, that's increased. What does that mean in our churches? What does that mean in our families? So what might we see at the counseling center? We might see throughout one day. We might have some student in suicidal crises, some struggling with an eating disorder, some having a substance abuse issue, some engaging in some kind of self-injury, and some maybe feeling really guilty about their sexual choices. Not feeling right about it, but just keep repeating the pattern. I don't know why I do this. They look on the surface very different, right? Like they're completely separate phenomenon and need separate treatment. And I'm not saying there's never a time for separate treatment. I think, of course, there is if those go pretty extreme and long-term. But what's interesting is I think a lot of them have some things in common, right? What those people are saying is they want relief.
and all those things provide relief in the short run. So if I'm binging or purging or cutting or drinking or having sex or whatever, I'm not thinking about what's distressing me. And if I can't calm myself down and can't sit with distress, I might take desperate measures to get relief. And that's how we clinically sometimes have to understand it. Different authors have described it with various terms, but something along the lines of that people are having difficulty regulating their tension or their emotions, and a difficulty tolerating distress. So when I'm upset, do I know how to calm myself? Or do I know that sometimes I can just be upset? And that nobody ever died from being upset, but sometimes they died from trying to run away from being upset, right? So some of those things I just described a minute ago are basically viewed as, at least sometimes, desperate attempts that work in the short run. But of course, what I would tell the students, and they are finding out in their own lives, they cause more problems in the long run. So yeah, of course, if I'm drinking too much, I'm not thinking about my midterms or my finances or my conflict with my parents tonight, but now I have a DUI, and now I have financial problems, and I'm in trouble with the university, and now I hopefully have not caused some very serious injury to someone. One theory about this comes from Breer, actually in the trauma field. He says that in the field of child abuse, what basically has happened, and I'll make the translation to the general population in a second, bear with me, but what basically has happened is people got way too much stress way too soon in their life. So imagine, for example, a normal developmental trajectory. A baby cries and they're distressed and, oh, mommy comes with milk. And, oh, they get left at kindergarten, but, oh, daddy picked them up. And, oh, man, our cat died, and that was so sad. But the family worked through it, right? They get normal developmental levels of distress throughout their life. Some people, think about people who experience abuse, they have the opposite experience. They get way too much, way too soon. The baby cries, and no one comes. The person's dropped off, the child's dropped off at school, and nobody picks them up, or worse, right? So those kids, they have way too much, way too soon. So then as adults, what do they want? They just want to turn off the distress. They feel a little anxiety, they want to turn it off. So Breer says that's like an off and on switch. So as we see them as college students or later adults, people who haven't had the opportunity to develop adjusting to various developmentally appropriate levels of stress little by little, they just want it off. So they feel a little bit of anxiety. I got a B. I had a breakup. I'm nervous about this speech. And sometimes they'll do pretty surprisingly desperate things. But some, Breer would say, they have not developed a dimmer switch. A dimmer switch is those babies that I just described. If they develop normally and have opportunity, oh, you know, I wanted the milk and mommy came. I dropped off at kindergarten and daddy picked me up. They learn a dimmer switch. So think about your own stress on a scale of 1 to 10. If you have a healthy way of dealing with your stress, you're aware of it throughout the day. I'm getting kind of stressed out. I'm going to call my friend for a minute. I'm going to go for a walk between these two clients because I've had enough right now. I'm going to breathe a little bit. I'm going to go get some tea. Right? You're constantly modulating your stress. But those who don't have it just want it off. Now, Breer originally did this research and conceptualization with child abuse victims, as I mentioned. But what I'm noticing, that was my actually original field academically and research-wise. And then when I switched to college mental health, I was surprised how many students had this phenomenon. They just wanted it off. They don't know how to deal with stress. They don't know how to regulate their tension. So I would say it's not necessarily child abuse anymore, but we want to pay attention to that too much too soon phenomenon. We'll talk more about that in different ways. But one of them is these children often grew up with the parents' best of intentions, too busy, too much activity, not enough downtime. That combination is overstressing them, too much too soon. And then they have also, and or, been overprotected. This generation of college students has been raised in a different way. They tend to have parents who have wanted to protect them from being distressed, from being disappointed, from having things not work out. So if you're overstressed, and overprotected as a child, surprise, surprise, you become a young adult and you're not really doing so well as far as regulating attention. Why are so many struggling? Let me see if you have any thoughts before I go to the peak already. But what would you guess? Why do you think mental health issues are changing nationally? What would you guess?
The economy.
Absolutely. What else? For families and for the prospects for them.
You don't have a job
right
inside, and your parents are struggling, you get you here.
Exactly. My husband's in the field of child abuse. When the economy dipped in 2008, you can be sure their business picked up too. Yeah.
And the economy also affects who stays home.
Right.
Or if someone's at all staying at home.
Right.
So.
Okay. So it can change family dynamics in ways that the family did or didn't choose.
Maybe the stress to get your kids into college in the first place. Mm-hmm. They work so hard. Mm-hmm.
So busy. Yeah, even the stress they have to deal with now, like, even at a middle school and a high school level, and what's expected of them, and to be able to to achieve anything later in life.
Okay, good. So you're raising many factors: financial issues, pressure to get into college, pressure earlier on. We kind of have a society that's cranked up on pressure, on achievement, on the next step. One thing I should mention first before I talk about some of those things, and I think the things you're mentioning all fall within this, but the first one before we do that is I do need to acknowledge this is good news. Meds are better. So some people who have physiological, pretty serious, medically based mental health issues are able to come to college now. They weren't able to before, but meds are better. That doesn't mean they won't need some support, but part of that's good news for the more extreme. But for the rest of the students, the ones where the increases there and what's up with that, yeah, societal influences are huge. One study kind of broke it down, looking at many, many other studies empirically, and then said basically this cohort has experienced a greater sense of threat growing up and a sense of less support. And threat can certainly include the economy, by the way, financial threat, the fear of things. Now, some would say, when I've given a talk similar, people say, come on, what about like the World War II generation? They survived the war, the Great Depression, et cetera. It wasn't in their face constantly. Right? This generation has grown up not only with some scary things happening, but all over the world, whether it's a tsunami or a shooting or a disaster or a disease, they've grown up very aware of it. And so there's local threats. Stuff can be happening in your church or your family. There's national and there's global threats that they are so, so very aware of. And then the other thing that's really important to look at is they feel less support. They feel less likely to answer positively to questions like, there's people I could count on if I really needed it, or you can generally trust people. So think about that, what that does to your development. If you feel pretty threatened and not very supported, that's a bad combination. So think about that. Do you have any initial thoughts about what that implications for church or youth groups or those kinds of things? If you're thinking about how you can help, part of the answer is, how can you reduce the sense of threat? How can you increase the level of support? Any thoughts about that?
Do people feel less threatened by these big things when they're able to engage in a helpful way? Of, you know, like I've been able to do a big sale and raise money to send to orphans and wherever, you know.
Good, I think that's a great example. So, and that kind of, you think how that, did you hear her question? So you could, for example, engage them in the threat. So for example, if they hear of some disaster happening, if instead of just feeling helpless and hopeless about it, okay, this youth group does a bake sale for it. So they're in community, they're feeling supported, and they're trying to make a difference. That's a great example.
I was just thinking, keep the news off.
I was about to say that too. Keep the news off, largely for young children. You think they don't pick up on it, they absolutely do pick up on it. So for young children, keep it off. For older children, be very thoughtful. For yourself, be very thoughtful. If you are obsessed with the latest shooting, the latest plane crash, the latest tsunami, whatever, and you're watching it all day long, even if you somehow protected your children from watching it, you're changed and they're changed indirectly. But the sense of support, I think, is super important too, this sense of less support. What we find with Pepperdine students, and I think is the national trend, is they tend to be quite busy. very engaged. They would have a list of all the clubs and organizations they belong to. But that's very different than, do you have those deeper connections? People who know me. People who I could call if I really needed it. So they zip off to their sorority meeting, followed by their other club. They are going to be an RA on rounds tonight. And they're zipping around. They're doing all kinds of good things. Their resumes look great. But do they really have somebody that they can connect with? So think about that as you raise your children. I love Mary Piper's, just even the book title, In the Shelter of Each Other. Right? Are your children growing up in the shelter of each other? Is your church community a sense of shelter in each other? Other things that have been mentioned is the access to information and images, the speed of life, a sense of spiritual void, and lots of family changes and dysfunction. People will often, though, refer to things like, oh, the divorce rate, oh, broken families. That's been stable for a long time. That's not the issues. Now, there are certainly a range of issues, but in a population like ours, at least, part of what we're seeing is the more subtle forms of dysfunction that I already mentioned. This sort of over-parenting, very structured, very busy, very parental involved childhoods. So, for example, I had a colleague who said his kids were in gymnastics and a parent came to pull kids out because they were late for swimming lessons. Mm-hmm. They weren't even done with their lesson for it. You have a thought?
Yeah, the over-parenting, that is such a counterintuitive
version. Yeah.
And I see it all. I'm a children's minister in New York City, and it's those parents that come around, like every parent everywhere, it's like access to the best, to the most.
Right.
And it creates
anxiety.
How do you find it's most effective talking to parents that you can speak into that?
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes I tell, I don't know, I have younger kids, so like the younger, you know, there's the mom that's following the one kid around on the playground.
Right, exactly.
Making sure that they're not going to fall.
Yes.
And so you're like, well, I think they'll be fine. Of course, then they fall and break their arm, and I'm, you know, whatever. But how do you speak into that over-parenting notion? Because it feels like we're doing a good job.
Yeah. Well, part of, you know, the beginning part about what are your goals, helping parents think about their goals. So their goal in that moment is they don't want Johnny to fall. Okay, well-intended, but guess what? Johnny could probably fall and probably get up and probably have implications for future life, right? So part of it is helping them think of their life. Do you want Johnny to always be protected? You'll see in a minute kind of where I'm going with this. But the overall idea of don't encouraging them not to be so protected, but you have to be empathetic that they are dealing, they're doing it for the best of intentions. But they are often, not only are they super busy, sometimes they're not hearing or respecting a child's cues. I remember my own son one time, he was in basketball camp for the first time, said, "Oof, I'll be glad when this is over." Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, Josh, you know, it takes a while to get good at something." He said, "Oh, I know I'm good, I'm just too busy." I was like, okay, got it. And then, yeah, just attending to those either direct or indirect, watching kids distress. Parents also run interference or try to fix things. So your kid didn't make a traveling soccer team, so you're calling and making a donation, whatever, or you're letting a kid learn to deal with disappointments that sometimes they don't make the team, and life goes on. What are these kids not getting if they're being overprotected and overstressed? They're not getting downtime. They're not getting imaginative play. They're not getting life balance. They're often missing out on family rituals. There's a ton of research about that, how important daily family rituals, like meals together, bath time together, as well as occasional family rituals, like a traditional vacation or whatever. Opportunities to work things out on their own. Opportunities to deal with disappointment, conflict, and less than ideal circumstances. Opportunities to learn emotional regulation. So again, back to the beginning, point your children in the way that they should go. Which way are you trying to go? Right, keep thinking about them. Just a few quick quotes. I won't read all of them in the interest of time, but the role of technology is something to consider in that. I like this older quote, "Our computers can link us, but they prevent us from looking into one another's eyes. Fill and order our time, but fail to add meaning to our lives and might distract us from things that might." Or more recent research looking at how things like texting and computer emails and stuff can be have a drug-like effect on the brain. You're constantly getting that little rush and how addicting that is. also the research about comparison and jealousy in Facebook, especially with adolescents. They're constantly, in young adults, they're constantly, she looks prettier than I do, she seems busier than I am, he seems to have more friends than I do. And again, that stress, like you guys mentioned, the news, Poe's Heart and the Mountain Climber, that author talks about, think about what happens even before we, you know, barely wake up. We look into TV casts of riots, violent protests, killings. Over breakfast, we read about infectious diseases, et cetera, et cetera. And from the shelter of each other, she talks about how things have changed over the years. Communities used to rally together to fight difficulties like natural disasters, and now they don't have that, but I like her ending there. In some ways, it's more rewarding to milk a cow or bake a pie for hungry children than it is to fill out paperwork for an insurance company or supervise disgruntled employees. So we're overall stressed. Swenson talks about it in terms of margins. He says, just like you should have your finances in a way that you have room for emergencies, we need to live our lives with emotional and time margins, too. Progress gives us more and more, faster and faster, but it's on a collision course with natural human limits. And again, we're raising children in this environment. So what do we do? A few things to think about. I love the M. Scott Peck quote. To paraphrase, basically, he says, life is hard. Once you accept that, it's not so hard. I would say this generation needs to hear more about that. Needs to be raised with that. Life is hard, and that's okay. Why do they fall apart? They haven't learned those lessons. So they need opportunities to develop those skills. Now, where's God in this? Doesn't a biblical worldview help with this? One would hope so. And certainly research shows that it can. Pergamon and others have done research to say that faith, of course, can be a resilience factor. With parents who have children with disabilities, people dealing with grief and loss, physical pain, faith can be a great source of resilience. But it isn't always. And I like Dallas Willard's quote here. We often talk about the cost of discipleship, as we should, right? But Willard points out, what about the cost of non-discipleship? If we're not really following deeply, it costs us abiding peace, a life penetrated by love, faith that sees everything in light of God's overriding good, governance for good. Hopefulness, this is what I want for our students, hopefulness that stands firm in the most discouraging circumstances, et cetera, et cetera. In short, non-discipleship costs you exactly the abundance of life that Christ came to bring. But we don't always see this. We don't always see that faith anchoring resilience. Of course, let me be clear in my position. Of course, I think Christian students are going to have problems. I don't think they're exempt from life circumstances. I don't think they're exempt from family issues or physiologically based issues or stressors. So, of course, I expect them to have problems. But what I'd like to see is faith helping them. Instead, let me share a few examples of what I see where I don't see faith helping them. One type of student, or one sort of variation that I see, is for some students, faith is just one more area in which to excel. And again, I invite you to back this up and think about the age of your children or grandchildren or youth group. How are we creating that image? Because what I see them is being very, very busy, even with good Christian faithful things to do, versus ever being still and knowing that he's God. Some of them are almost trying to become super Christians, as if they're trying to create this resume line after line after line about how involved they are, how good they are, how much they're serving. And of course I want them to serve and be good and be involved, but at what point is it too much and really counter to a faith development, spiritual formation? I had one client literally say to me, I think at 19 years old, I haven't created a nonprofit yet. You got time, babe. You know, there's a little bit of work to go. Some students use spiritual language, but it's not really a Christian worldview. But look at this. This like, student said this to me. God hasn't blessed my family like he should. All right. Not surprising that wouldn't be helpful in terms of resilience. But probably what I see most often is this, where the student is just not connecting faith to their life. So we asked on intake, for example, at the counseling center, what their faith background is, how important it is to them. Some will say, faith is very important to me, you know, the highest number. But then, okay, tell me what's going on. Well, my boyfriend of 3 months broke up with me, okay, and I'm thinking about killing myself. Okay, that was literally the case. Whoa. you know, again, of course, I think heartbreak is going to be there when there's a disappointing breakup. But to think that someone's faith would not help that from being an option, or at least a first option, was quite shocking to me. Or we see it in eating disorders. Again, I don't think Christian students are exempt from eating disorders. They live in this world. They may have family dynamics or physiological issues that make that more likely for them. But it's when I don't see them connecting at all. So when they're saying, I hate myself, I hate my body, I hate everything about myself, and not any of the other, not, but I know God loves me, or I know I was fearfully and wonderfully made, and I can't reconcile these two. If I heard them saying both, I would feel very differently, but it's almost like never the twain shall meet in their thinking. Like if I hadn't seen the form, I wouldn't necessarily know that they had a faith. So what do we want for them? I want them to have realistic expectations of the world, and I want them to develop, I think of it as their psychological muscles of emotional regulation and distress tolerance. I share this picture often with clients because it really is true. They think life is going to be like that first one, that they're just going to go right down to the finish line. It's going to be really easy. But with a little bit of life, most of us know it's not like that. There are pitfalls, and there are valleys, and there is rain and clouds and so on, and you can make it through that. But if you've been raised to think it's going to be like the first one, no surprise that when they hit this first valley, it's pretty disturbing. So somehow we've got to raise our kids prepared that life is hard sometimes. I think about it in the hymns. What do we say, even in a contemporary Christian version? Blessed be your name in the land that's plentiful, where your streams of abundance flow, blessed be your name. But when I'm found in the desert place and I walk through the wilderness, blessed be your name, right? But it doesn't matter. Or the classic, it is well with my soul. When peace like a river attends my way, or when sorrows like sea billows roll, still be well with my soul. Again, not happy, not thrilled, not that's what I chose, but there can be that deep, resilient faith. How do we get there? Just some things to think about. Imagine again the muscle image. Imagine if we sent people to train in college-level athletics to compete in college-level athletics who had never worked out, had never trained, had never practiced. It would be ridiculous. I would argue it's kind of similar, that we're sending people off to navigate disappointments, frustrations, heartache, life not going exactly like they wanted, without ever giving them opportunity to develop the muscles that are necessary. So how do we do that even much younger? We got to help kids understand that it is okay. You get to have every emotion. You get to be angry. You get to be disappointed. You get to be upset. Emotions are okay. I like books along the lines of When Sophie Gets Angry, Very, Very Angry. It's a really sweet book for children that shows a little blow-up in between the two siblings. But then, next step, there are ways to calm down. Think of it like a bag of tools. And I don't think you can hardly start too young with helping kids develop a range of options. I see you're upset. You know, talk about what's going on, and then what can they do to calm themselves down? What can you do? Teach what you do. And don't just do it, talk about what you do. Well, you notice when mom comes home from work, she often takes a bath before she gets dinner ready. Do you know what's going on there? Mommy's calming herself down, right? Like, it is okay to speak to that. Don't act like you don't have any emotions or that you're never distressed. Teach them what you're doing. Show them what you're doing. Normalize difficulty. Don't always rush to fix it. And help them learn to sit with pain. This too shall pass. You are still loved. You are still of value. Whether you made the team or the play or whatever, God is still with you. How are you giving those messages? How are you teaching Romans in your life? That all things will work together for good. That nothing can separate us from God's love. But some bad things will happen, right? Neither of those promises, nothing bad will happen. Where is faith in this? Super important to keep nurturing, I think, a deep connection with God. That sense that God is always with you. That God is always for you. God is always loving you. That is not dependent on performance. that grace and gratitude, grace is central, gratitude for grace. I think you can teach that at a pretty young age. Help them begin to put faith as a perspective-taking strategy and helps them press on towards goals. And in little ways, depending on the developmental level, that they expect suffering, that sometimes life is hard. Everybody know that Alexander and the horrible, terrible, no good, very bad day? There's wisdom in that. Some days are like that, right? Do we act like they aren't any days like that? What is not helpful, it's been shown in the research, not helpful, surprise, surprise, to be constantly guilt-inducing, a sinner's in the hands of an angry God thing, where you think you're right on the edge of falling into hell at any moment. Turns out that's not good for your mental health. So try to avoid that. And also try to avoid it just being task-oriented. I'm not saying there's not a value in Christian disciplines. Of course there is. But don't make faith one more thing, like you got to brush your teeth, you got to vacuum your room, and you got to read your Bible. Don't do that. Like, this is about a relationship. This is about something much deeper, a bigger anchor in that. Otherwise, just like they don't want to brush their teeth, they don't want to do that either. And that it's not a performance-oriented area. Again, this would be my wish for them, you know, as you're thinking about your parenting choices, like, you're wanting them to be rooted and established in love so they could have power together with all Lord's holy people to grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ. Now, sometimes you might explicitly discuss that. That would be a great discussion at dinner table. Right? Like, how wide, how deep, how low, that'd be beautiful, or in Sunday school or whatever. But I don't always mean it just overtly like that. I mean, are you living life like that is true? That is anchoring us, that is helping us through the darkest times. Another practical thing I would just encourage us to think about, the coping literature speaks often to these basic first three things. That coping of pretty much anything involves understanding the problem accurately, engaging in meaningful problem solving, effective problem solving, and managing your emotions. Right? That's good no matter what. You got some bad tax news. All right, what's the reality of it? What are we going to do to pay for it? And what am I going to do with my disappointment about this? Right? What does this breakup mean? Are we done for good? What do I need to do to take care of myself right now? How am I going to settle myself? Those are very basic coping things. I think from a Christian point of view, we should also ask ourselves, and where's God in this? Where is God in this? But again, day to day, I think we need to teach this to our kids. So imagine, for example, a little thing. These are just day-to-day examples. Your first grader loses her worksheet that's due tomorrow, right? What's the quick way to fix it? Mommy just finds it, right? Oh, don't worry, honey, here it is. But you miss an opportunity to teach a kid to learn to cope, right? So, okay, so let's think. You don't know where your paper is. Where, you know, are you sure you brought it home? Did you have it after carpool? Oh, you didn't have it. Okay. Engage in confident action. Call Miss Jones, who brought you home. Maybe it's in her car. But have your child make that call. And then settle yourself down while you're waiting to see if she has it, right? And it sounds ridiculous at that example. But I think what happens, back to the parents that you're dealing with, if they have fixed every little situation, the kid has not learned the basic coping strategies. And you think about, okay, that one maybe doesn't have the fourth step, but imagine a friend conflict. Just even fifth grade friend conflict. So-and-so's mad at me. They're not talking to me anymore. Okay? What do you think happened? Tell me the story. Whatever. Oh, so you did something first. Okay, you need to apologize there. What's going on? Or you don't understand. You need more information. How can you ask? Da, da, da. Right? And then if there is issues like forgiveness or grace or whatever, that might be part of the conversation. But you help them go through it. You had a thought.
Well, what if it's the same emotional problem for the 15 weeks in a row? And you're just so beat down by it. And you're like, I don't know, I can't. How do you deal? Or like my first grader has not brought his book back home, like his little books, 20 times. Like it continues. And I'm at wit's end. I looked at the. Can you put the slide back up again? Like,
I don't feel like he understands that it's a problem. Do you know what I mean? Like, so...
It may not be for
you. Yeah, it, not, it is a problem. Fundamentally, he will not have to go to school here if he doesn't bring knowledge. So how... Like, that makes... It's, I want to be that person. It's so calm. Stepping through all three things. And at the end, my dad, you're so great. You're helping me understand, engage, and manage my emotions. But it's the repeat.
Right.
And in all seriousness, speaking to other parents, like week after week after week after week, they're still there.
The same thing.
Yeah,
and I wouldn't suggest this is all...
Okay.
Yeah, and that is part of it. Is letting kids experience
natural
consequences.
I'm not going to let it bother me anymore, even though I'm lying.
Right.
I'm not going to let it bother me anymore. Okay. And do I say that to my parents? I mean, that's
There's a line there of not letting it bother you anymore, depending on what it is, right? Because if they deal with the disappointment, the embarrassment, et cetera, of not having their papers or their books or whatever handled back at school or whatever, then at some point it becomes a distress potentially for them versus you. Right. If we're trying to be too proactive, it's not an easy solution. But part of it is letting the chips fall where they may, and having natural consequences. And sometimes they're not needing to cope because they're not distressed yet. Right. Let me just run through this rest, and I have you talk to people. No, it's great. It's a good everyday example. So, and maybe this relates to this one: high standards and not perfectionism. Check yourself. What's your reason for you wanting your kids? Worksheet done or backpack home, what's your own motivation? You want to be viewed as a good parent, a perfect parent, a super dad, whatever. Right? We all have our moments. But notice how if you have perfectionistic standards, that tends to create paralysis, not a positive biblical worldview, which is I have gifts and talents given by God and I'm going to fully develop them. And you want to, instead of encouraging perfectionism among your children, encourage a balanced life, a sense of the value of Sabbath and valuing relationships overall. Stay close is another strategy. Attachment, we know, is super important for long-term coping. So stay close, but not too close. Letting go should be a gradual process, from kindergarten to an overnight to a visit with grandma for a few days or whatever. Attachment is critical, but it allows, healthy attachments allow for exploration. Help them value other real relationships too, not just the online ones, to understand that sense of shelter of each other. Limit box time. You've heard that advice before, whether it's computers or games or TV, so that they are looking into others' eyes to really develop empathy. And last but not least, gratitude has been shown to be a huge resiliency component. The field of positive psychology has found all kinds of research recently that it makes a big difference in people's mental health, physical health, and social relationships. But God knew that a long time ago, right? There's all kinds of scriptures about the value of gratitude, that people can choose to be grateful or not, to express gratitude or not, like lepers, for example. Some do, some don't, right? But again, those are good things to talk about around a family table or a Sunday school or youth group. Avoid entitled attitudes. Speak about gratitude regularly in your life. So grateful for this friend, so grateful for this opportunity. Expose children and teens to those with less, and check your own attitude. Teach what you mean to teach, and show them how to express attitude, gratitude, and including for their identity in Christ, that they're children of God, that they're lavished with love, that they're chosen, all that, deep, deep. I'm struck in Colossians how many times giving thanks is connected with identity in Christ. Giving thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in his inheritance. Over and over again, giving thanks, identity in Christ, giving thanks, identity in Christ. So last but not least, watch your own lives as parents, grandparents, aunts, uncles, ministers. They are watching you more than they're listening to you. You know that. Can you roll with life's ups and downs? That's as important as anything. Are you being perfectionistic? Constantly trying to prove yourself. Does your faith ground you? Or do they just see the busyness? Or do they just hear the guilt? Or do they not see you making a connection? Do they hear you talking about your life? And then they hear you going to Sunday school, but they don't ever see it going together. Teach them how to make it go together from the time that they are little bitty through junior high and high school before they get here. Are you grateful? And are you, last but not least, beginning to end? So thanks very much. I'm happy to stay for a few minutes, but I think they want us to get out of the classroom. I got the clue.